This is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. And yeah, I'm supposed to be working right now. I'm on the radio, but I'm also browsing YouTube.
Good morning. This is Girlicious Adamant.
I'm watching a video by a Seattle area family. The parents are both UW graduates. Their channel is called It's Judy's Life. And on the video I have pulled up, there's a toddler helping her mom making breakfast. Two older daughters are using a toy that makes candy shaped like other foods. A young girl is brushing her teeth using a new cup we just saw her buy at Daiso earlier in the video.
Hi, guys.
Of course, Judy is far from the only parent to document her kids online.
Great Wolf Lodge in Centralia, Washington. My baby girl and sons had a blast at the indoor water park.
We wanted to capture all the great things we did this summer, and we really focused on just spending time with family.
If you want to keep your kids entertained in the snow, you got to get these snow molds.
What is up, guys? Welcome back to my channel. If you're new here, I'm Lizzie, and we have Rowan here. Today, she is going to control my life for the next 24 hours.
TikTok, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, there are lots of platforms where posting your kids can be a full-time job. And with pays for views and brand deals, it can be a pretty lucrative one. Last year, former Washington State Representative Emily Wicks proposed a bill meant to protect kids who appear in videos like this. It was looking out for, quote, the interests of minor children featured in for-profit family vlogs.
People are posting their, you know, photos of their kids online, which is great. And, you know, doing that with your family and sharing that is great. But when you start to collect revenue from doing that, it does become an issue with how often you're using your children. And what you're kind of forcing them to do.
The idea for the bill was brought to Emily by a local high school student named Chris McCarty, who took on the issue as a Girl Scout project. And Emily says a lot of her fellow representatives were really excited about the prospect of protecting kids' interests online. But the bill fizzled. The committee it went to didn't have time to consider it thoroughly. Emily is no longer a representative. She decided against running for re-election. But the idea for her bill may still live on. The high school student who first brought this to her attention is now working with Democratic Representative Christine Reeves of Federal Way to bring the bill back before the legislature. And as you might imagine, this is not something social media companies would be happy to endorse.
I don't think it's just something they wouldn't support and go out on a limb to support. I think it's something that they would actively kind of champion against and work against. They don't want to do anything that would cause them to make a lot of changes.
She says those changes may be tough to figure out, like how to remove content if the young person asks for privacy after they turn 18, or how to pay them properly in the future. Still, Emily Wicks says it's necessary.
Because they've kind of created this, and it's great, and there's a lot of great opportunities with it, but there is also a lot of risks and a lot of things that, you know, create more challenges that we need to address. And I hope my colleagues see that. They've been working a lot on data and technology and those protections, and I hope this could fall within that work.
There are some laws that already exist to protect kids online, like the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which requires parental consent to gather data from kids under the age of 13, or the Children's Internet Protection Act, which is meant to limit kids' access to obscene or harmful content online. But those laws don't address how parents or social media companies can profit off of child influencers. Professor Jessica Maddox says that needs to change. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Journalism and Creative Media at the University of Alabama, researching social media platforms, internet popular culture, and feminist media studies through qualitative research methods. Hi, Professor Maddox. Thanks for being on Soundside.
Hey, thanks for having me.
When we watch videos by family creators, the kids don't look unhappy most of the time. I mean, sometimes there's a video that shows a meltdown or a tantrum, but usually they're doing things like playing with toys, going on trips. What is the concern here? Why are safeguards important for kids that are featured in influencer videos?
Absolutely. You know, there's nothing wrong with families having fun by any means. A lot of the kids in these videos are happy, right? It's sometimes fun to be in mommy and daddy's video, playing pretend for the internet. But the concern for these family influencer videos, the family vlogging videos, when we see children of these famous vloggers and influencers, the concern is that children don't understand the long-term ramifications of their whole lives being content on the internet, that the things that go online now can go far beyond the intended audience, that it can live on the internet forever. So when these children become adults, what from their childhood remains online? And then two, also the financial and ethical questions of, are these children essentially being compensated for what work they are doing in their parents' internet jobs?
I gotta say, when I first started prepping for this segment, I had not spent any time in this online world. We truly are a fragmented society these days where people can be in these media bubbles that other folks have no idea about. When I started clicking through some of these videos, I was just very confused. Maybe let's rewind. Can you talk to me about the appeal of sharenting videos, what they are, how they grow audience, and what kind of reach do they have online? I mean, what kind of audiences do they reach?
Yeah, so the appeal of sharenting videos is really the appeal of all influencer, all content creator videos. We go online to have enjoyment and also maybe see parts of the world or parts of people's lives that are different from our own. So plenty of people that don't have children, don't have a family that looks like that yet, watch these videos as well. Kids often watch these videos as well, seeing themselves reflected in media. So the appeal in these videos does lie in, they are funny. They can be wholesome. Sometimes they can be cruel. There have been videos, instances of parents pulling pranks on their kids. And right, sometimes pranks can be harmless. For instance, I saw many personally, you know, of parents joking that they had gotten Taylor Swift tickets for their kids only to realize they actually hadn't.
So cruel. Like
isn't it? I in my 30s would be very upset if somebody did that to me. But also in the grand scheme of things, harmless prank. But some of these pranks have become more harmful, of faking injuries, faking members of the family going missing, and filming responses for internet clout.
Yeah, there is this gaping maw of the content machine needs to be filled. So sometimes influencers, including these family influencers, escalate what they're doing. You know, they just have this sort of cycle where they're upping the game, and that can kind of be alarming.
Yeah, for sure. Everybody is looking to carve out a niche for themselves online. That's kind of how you have to stand out. There's so much going on the internet. Just like you said a few moments ago, we wind up in these little bubbles. We don't know what's happening everywhere. We can't even consume all of the content in the niche area we like. There's so much of it. But to stand out online, you have to have a niche. You have to have a brand. You have to have that thing that makes you different. And a lot of family vloggers or these sharenting influencers have used their children as that way to try to stand out online.
Why is the concern here different from family home videos that have been around since the camcorder was invented? You know, you share it with a circle of friends. Maybe it's emailed out to friends and relatives. What's different about what's happening online with YouTubers and influencers?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, even when I was a kid in the early 90s, you know, I have a distinct memory of, you know, my parents would break out the camcorder that was so large it had to sit on your shoulder and be like, oh, you know, watch the dance. I learned a dance class today, right? Harmless fun gets shown as I grow up and, you know, at family gatherings to embarrass me. That's harmless. There's absolutely, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I think the concern with the internet is we are not in control of what we put online. Online content very quickly bypasses its intended audience. We see this with videos that go viral with so-called cancel culture. Things people don't think will reach the masses can very easily reach the masses. In other words, it can go far beyond its intended audience, and it can also stick around forever. So also in the case of these children, even if it doesn't necessarily go beyond maybe a niche circle of social media audience right now, 10, 15 years from now, when they're adults trying to get into colleges, applying for jobs, what does a Google search of their name reveal 10, 15 years down the road? May it be something they may not like? So that's the concern. That's the difference between, you know, filming a fun little family video with the camcorder and filming something and putting it on YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, where even if you take it down, you don't know who's downloaded it. You don't know who has recorded it in some capacity and shared it in ways you could never imagine. And I'm not here to try to scare anybody or cause alarm. It's something I even teach my college freshmen in social media and society, that the internet is forever. We don't have to be afraid of it, but just be mindful and be careful of it.
You recently wrote in The Conversation, we need an updated Coogan Act for the digital age. What does that mean? What is the Coogan Act?
Yeah, so the Coogan Act is an act that emerges out of early Hollywood, named after Jackie Coogan, who is hailed as America's first child actor. He was in Charlie Chaplin movies and really gained immense fortune for his work as a child actor. The problem was there was nobody looking out for his financial interests. And when he grew up, turned 18, and was able to receive the money he had earned as a child, he found out that his mother and stepfather had squandered away almost all of it. After that, the Coogan Act was passed in California, and several other states have adopted versions of this law as well, that states children in the entertainment industries, music, I believe modeling to some extent, acting, any kind of Hollywood industry, their financial interests must be safeguarded and must be protected. The funds must be put in some form of trust for them to access once they grow up.
So the money is, you know, put aside, and this is something that, you know, is supposed to safeguard them for later in life, so that unlike Jackie Coogan, unlike maybe some other child actors, when I was younger, also in the 90s, Macaulay Culkin was in the news a lot because his parents were using his money in a really bitter custody dispute. The idea is that these children's financial interests are safeguarded. But what about federal labor laws? I mean, aren't there some of, you know, restrictions on exploiting kids just in the workplace that it should apply here?
Absolutely. So there is no federal version of the Coogan Act. What gets complicated on social media is that lines between labor and play very much blur. So for instance, a child, you know, appearing in their parents' video, we may not think of that immediately as work, as labor. But if the parent is receiving any type of sponsored deal or brand deal or advertisement for their work, in theory, the child is benefiting or could benefit from that income the parent is getting for the sponsored content. I teach college students about social media, about how social media are places for careers we don't think of. People scoff at the idea of influencers and content creators as viable careers. But in this day and age, in this media landscape, they absolutely are. It's not to say it's easy. It takes hard work, just like anything else. But these are viable career paths. And so we do need to think that if family influencers, family vloggers are getting any type of brand deals or sponsored content off of their children, it is worth considering, should that money be put away then, or a percentage of that money be put away for that children as they grow up?
I was really interested to see what Washington State had to say about this. There's a patchwork of protections for child performers depending on the state that you're in. 17 states have no protections. In Washington, children do have to obtain work permits from the Department of Labor if they're employed in film, video, audio, or theater productions. And employers, if they go long hours, if they have the work happen during school hours, you know, very late, very early, they have to get special waivers in order to employ children in that manner. Do any family vloggers or sharenting influencers abide by these types of work standards, like getting permits from the Department of Labor, you know, putting aside a certain amount of money under the Coogan law? that you're aware of? Is this something that influencers pay attention to at all?
So I am not aware of any that currently do this. That is not to say, you know, it doesn't happen. Certainly on a case-by-case basis, parents could be putting money away for their children and college funds or savings and things like that. I'm sure, again, on a case-by-case basis could absolutely be happening. But the fact that there is no systemic protection in place is concerning. We don't know what goes on behind the scenes of a camera. We don't know how many takes it took or how long it took to get the content. I've recently just started trying to make TikTok videos myself. I am not good at it, and they take a long time, and they actually take quite a long time to make. So it is worth considering, you know, what's going on in the background for these children that are featured in their parents' videos.
I think it's notable, too, that even federal labor standards or the Coogan Act, we're talking about laws that govern pay, laws that govern their financial interests and the number of hours that they work. But there's nothing on the books at all about consent, about privacy, about the mental health effects later in life. And these are things that even child performers who are protected by these existing laws talk about later on, that they suffered, some of them, pretty extreme consequences, right? I mean, why aren't we having these conversations? Or is this happening in some corners?
Absolutely. So the good news is, I think we are starting to have this conversation more intensely. What even brought me to this issue to write my piece for The Conversation was starting to see a lot more grassroots conversations on TikTok where children whose parents put their entire lives online are now speaking up about how upsetting those experiences were for them, how if they had had it their way, they would have never wanted their entire life blasted all over the internet for people to see.
My name is Cam, and my mom put my entire life essentially on social media, especially my medical history, just a lot about things medically with me, whether it was physical health or my mental health.
So this isn't to say these conversations haven't been happening. They have definitely been happening for a while. But one thing as someone who studies social media, I am seeing them start to accelerate at a rate I haven't seen before. Many of these things these TikTokers are talking about their parents oversharing their lives, have to do with things that are very private to a person that the parent is choosing to discuss widely in front of tens of thousands, if not millions of followers. It is a lot more of an intimate look into someone's life than playing a character on a TV show.
Social media is in a weird place right now. A panel in the U.S. House of Representatives is set to vote on a bill that would ban TikTok next month, ban TikTok across the United States. Meta, the parent company for Instagram and Facebook, has laid off 11,000 people. Twitter shares are way down. Of course, the Musk era has kind of sent that platform into a tailspin. How are influencers faring right now? Are they still garnering the views that they were a couple of years ago? Have they had to shift strategies because of the rise of TikTok or the changing social media landscape?
Absolutely. You're spot on that social media is in a weird, weird place right now for all the reasons you just mentioned. Influencers and content creators have very precarious careers, right? All their income is contingent on getting a sponsored deal, on bringing in views, and you never know where the next sponsorship is going to come from. It also means constantly learning about new platforms and trying to adopt them so that you bring your audience with you, that you learn the features so you can keep competing and keep earning your income. So it's a very precarious job. It's a very precarious type of labor. But what's also fascinating about influence right now has been the turn to de-influencing that I've seen just over the past couple of days really take off in earnest on TikTok regarding an influencer who was using mascara but actually had applied fake lashes instead.
Oh, I just saw this. Yes. And everyone's obsessed with whether it was actually the mascara or whether she did a quick cut to fake lashes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The fact that I know this, I'm slightly embarrassed, but yes, go on.
It's okay. I have to know these things for work. So allegedly, you know, nothing's been proven or disproven yet. There may be fake lashes instead of the mascara. And so this has led people, there's led to a lot, again, grassroots conversation with the hashtag de-influencing of don't buy this really expensive product that seems to be really popular on TikTok or Instagram, buy this cheaper version instead, which is still a form of influencing, right? In and of itself, still buy this, but buy the cheaper version.
Yeah, there's still a lot of money in selling the knockoff version or the cheaper version for sure. You know, it strikes me that one obstacle to regulating kids and their usage online or their exploitation online is that a child can choose to be on social media themselves and create their own brand. Most websites allow kids to make accounts when they're 13 years old. All of these companies profit off of child creators and child influencers as well. Doesn't this all come down to the platforms themselves and whether they're properly regulating the potential exploitation of these young performers or influencers?
Absolutely. When we talk about any form of updated Coogan Act for social media, we have to look at the role platforms play in it as well. Because yes, there's parents, there's children who are immensely successful, but there's also the companies that, you know, kids do toy unboxing videos, right? So sponsored companies from toy sponsored videos from toy companies. So we have to look at the role platforms play in this. Platforms can make or break a creator's career depending on the algorithm, their content moderation policies. And that doesn't just apply to adult influencers, but children as well. Are platforms helping or harming the children that make content on their site by maybe amplifying it to maybe not the best audience if through the recommendation algorithm and things like that? It's also important to know that platforms make a lot of money off advertisements that run on videos, off of these creators themselves. And if platforms are making money off the content of minors, I think that is a conversation we need to have as well.
I am an older millennial, and I grew up at a time when I really had free reign of the internet. I mean, nobody was monitoring my use. I remember going on message boards and, you know, being in conversation with people on AOL Instant Messenger. There was no safeguard. I mean, anyone could have been talking to me, but it was fine. I mean, I never encountered anything that was really terrible. There was never anybody trying to lure me into some kind of kidnapping situation or show me anything, you know, disgusting. I think about kids today, I do think that things have changed, but I have a hard time putting my finger on what, because again, you kind of get into that back in my day, everything was better, you know, mindset once you reach a certain age, and it's hard for you to have perspective on, you know, what's really going on today. So I guess my question is the internet of today, Professor Maddox, more dangerous for kids than it was, say, in the 90s?
It's a great question. So also as an elder millennial, I grew up with very little free reign. Nothing, to my knowledge, bad ever happened to me based on my online experiences. The internet today is much more consolidated around many similar hubs. The internet we may have experienced 15, 20 years ago was a lot more fragmented in message boards, LiveJournal, Zanga, you know, all multiple blogging websites. It wasn't as centralized. So now we have the big platforms, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, Snapchat. And there's a lot more people gathering around these hubs instead of 15, 20 years ago, where the hubs were more spread out and we were all more spread out across those hubs. Again, on one hand, this is great, more connection, access to things you may not have ever had the chance to experience before. Definitely great learning potential in these hubs. But it also means things spread faster because they are more contained when we're in these kind of big hubs. They can go far beyond the intended audience. And it's that kind of structuring that really makes the internet of today different than what we had 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, and social media of today is so different than a message board was in 1998. You know, it was just a different incentive structure, different type of reach, as you say. Here in Washington, the Seattle and Kent school districts have both filed lawsuits against Snapchat, YouTube, TikTok, and Meta. And they allege that the platforms violated Washington's public nuisance law and exploited students. Basically, they're arguing, the districts are arguing, that these platforms are at least partially responsible for the youth mental health crisis that has also caused a huge outlay of resources from schools. As somebody who studies social media platforms, what do you think about schools and educators going after platforms for this kind of effect on their students?
That's really interesting. I hadn't heard about these cases in Washington. I am familiar with the state of Indiana sued TikTok back in December for a similar reason, mental health, harmful content via the algorithm, and the like. And I think we're going to see more of this. Since we haven't had much luck regulating social media companies and therefore their platforms and their products at the federal level, I think we're going to see more individualized lawsuits like this, whether it's on a local or state level, in place of federal regulation. Again, social media can be great, but we also can't pretend that harm isn't there. I tell my students in my social media and society class, I'm not an apologist and I'm not an alarmist. I'm not going to apologize for or try to explain away the bad things that may happen on social media. But we also have to not, ring the alarm either every time something goes wrong. Context matters, education matters, and literacy matters as well.
I've steered us a bit far afield from our original topic, which was parent influencers and the effects on kids and what kind of laws should be in place to protect kids. So I guess I'm going to end with just a pushback on the calls for more regulation. Isn't this all free speech? I mean, isn't this all a family deciding what's best for their family, finding a way to make a little extra money on the side out of some really good, harmless and, entertaining fun that they already have as a family? I mean, wouldn't tighter regulation run into free speech laws in this country?
That's a great question. And one my students ask me about all the time as well. I think, again, not being a First Amendment scholar myself, but as somebody who studies social media and looks at these issues, I think context always matters, right? If it is, a family channel where everybody's having fun and everybody's having a good time, there isn't anything wrong with that. There's by certainly no means we can't enjoy ourselves in the content we make or the content we consume online. I think what we do need to look at is to take a step back and consider the fact that social media aren't going anywhere. They are a fixture of our media landscape. They are options for careers we couldn't have envisioned 10 years ago. And I think that's what we need to focus on. When we talk about social media regulation, I think it's important to look at that in terms of things, like mental health, like harmful, polarizing content. But in terms of the family influencers or in just any influencer or content creator, that's definitely within their right and their purview to post whatever they want. But again, context matters, and we should look kind of at the whole field, not just individual cases. I'm never here to indict any individual or, blame an individual, but instead look at the systems and the platforms and what we can do about them.
Yeah, I could talk about this all day. I'm just thinking about the ways that, for example, if the law protecting child performers' financial assets is expanded to include kids that appear in influencer videos, I mean, how do you separate out the earnings of those children from the earnings of the family? And, there's just so many questions surrounding this, but I think it's really important to tackle. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about this. Jessica Maddox, an assistant professor in the Department of Journalism and Creative Media at the University of Alabama. Also the author of the book, The Internet is for Cats, How Animal Images Shape Our Digital Lives. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. Don't forget you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime right here online at KUOW.org, or of course on your favorite podcast app.